Philip Adams here with you for another of the best of Late Night Live from last year. The next interview, along with 19 others, are available in this funny little gizmo called a Universal Series Bus or USB stick in ABC shops. So rush out and get one and be a sticky. G'day listeners, welcome to LNL. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. My guest in this program is going to provide such a memorable self-portrait that I intend to enter this radio program in the Archibald. It'll be the first radio program ever hung amongst all the paintings at the National Gallery, or the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And I can say this in confidence because my guest has hardly ever failed in a performance. Little wonder she's regarded as perhaps our greatest living stage actress. I speak, of course, of Robin Nevin. After 50 years on radio, stage and screen shows, little signs of slowing down, Robin began her acting career as a shy 16-year-old. Apparently she really was shy, in the first intake of students at NIDA, the National Institute of Dramatic Art, from whence she graduated in 1960. Ploughing through her CV, there's only 2 or 3 years where she hasn't performed on stage, and if she wasn't on stage, she was behind the scenes directing or running one of our major theatre companies, whether in Melbourne or Brisbane or Sydney. She's got a list of acting awards as long as your arm. She's starred in over 80 plays, 22 films for screen and telly, and directed 35 plays at last count. But who's counting? In fact, we've been fortunate to grab Robin between performances and costume fittings. She's currently performing in the Melbourne Theatre Company's production of the American hit drama Other Desert Cities, and she's also featuring in Jane Campion's latest TV miniseries, Top of the Lake. Robin joins me now from our Melbourne TARDIS. Thanks for finding the time, Robin.
Thank you, Philip. It's a very generous introduction.
We've never actually talked, have we, in all these years?
Yes. How dare you forget? We did talk. We talked at a Sydney studio. I can't remember what program you were then doing.
I'm smacking myself. Listen. There.
We had a bit of a talk about the film industry during the period in which you were so prominent and active. A bit of a chat about that. We did.
Okay, Philip, well, I'm sorry, but at my age, you know, I don't know how you remember the lines at your age. I can't even remember all the guests. Look, I was saying to you off air, asking if you'd worked with Michael Blakemore, and you said that you had in a really rotten play, but of course I'm mentioning Michael because in sort of preparation for our chat, I whizzed through yet again his novel called Next Season, which was early experiences as an actor trying to crack it in an English rep company. And I know of no better account of how bloody hard it is, in fact, to make it in your profession. It's an endless grind, isn't it, and a very tense profession.
Yes, it is tense, and tension is one of the very difficult aspects that you have to learn to manage, or it can kill you. You know, I mean, I used to lament the presence of most of my colleagues in foyers who were middle-aged, had left the profession, were either drunks or cynics, and a lot of that, I think, is as a result of the levels of stress that we confront all the time.
And it's not just the up-and-comers like the young Blakemore, or indeed the young you. In the novel, which is a lightly fictionalised account of terribly recognisable people, you see that even the Olivias, you know, had a constant battle against nerves, against professional jealousies, against up-and-comers, changing fashions in playwriting and indeed in performance.
It's a bit like politics when you think of it, you analyse it, any of them. I mean, those highly competitive professions have those similar characteristics. But yes, you're absolutely right. I was the other night, in fact, on stage, I had a momentary lapse of concentration or distraction. There was a distraction of some kind that caused this lapse, and I had a momentary panic. And that led me, that my brain, along the path of, wouldn't it be terrible if this was the beginning of the end of my ability to maintain concentration on stage, and I became like one of those broken people who eventually are defeated by nerves and panic attacks on stage. I was thinking all of this while I was continuing to do what I had to do on stage, so presumably that's a reasonable outcome for me. I seem to be able to do both at the same time, manage the panic and wonder what it might be like to have one and continue to say the lines. But I did dip into some personal stories of people I know who've experienced this terrible panic onset. I know Geoffrey Rush experienced it for some time, quite famously, and he overcame it. I know a friend of mine recently who had to cancel a season. He just fell out because of panic. And there's no clear, identifiable reason. It's just something that can happen.
Well, if one has panics and forgets lines, there's also the miracle of remembering them in the first place. And that's something else that I was reading in Michael's book with fascination, that the struggle, particularly in a rep context, you know, when you're juggling three parts, three productions,
yes,
of struggling to get all that into the head. Would you be kind enough to tell us your trade secret?
Practice. I've trained my brain. It's just what I can do. I mean, you know, I can't do other things, lots of many, many, many things, but that I can do. And it's interesting that I meet so many people who are fascinated by that particular ability. And I say, well, it's just training the brain. You know, the brain is eminently trainable, as we know. So that's all it is. And it's practice. It's keeping the muscle really practiced. At the moment, I'm learning lines for Angels in America, in which I play an ancient rabbi, and for
typical typecasting. I mean, you get all the parts of ancient rabbis. I know.
First person you'd think of. Who will we get to play an ancient rabbi? And a Peter Temple dramatized book. I'm his greatest fan, which I'm doing next Monday. So I'm cramming at the moment these two roles into my brain. But the way. Actually, I don't do it through cramming. I do it through reading them over and over and over and over and letting and kind of absorbing them and absorbing the meaning at the same time.
But it's not just the words you've got to remember. You've got to remember the lines of everyone. You've got to remember the ins and the outs, entries and exits, don't you? It is an astonishing juggling act. How many plays do you think you've got stored in your muscle?
I don't know. I haven't tried them. It's quite often interesting to come back to a production. We'll do a production a season in Melbourne, and then it's restaged to go to Brisbane. So there's an interim period of maybe 3 months or 8 months, and then we come back and gather as a cast for a week or 10 days rehearsal at the most. And we are able to pick up virtually where we left off. But I haven't tried any of the really long-term ones. Lear is one that I enjoy doing some of the speeches as warm-ups when I'm preparing for my work in the evening. And another one is the most marvellous, the Italian, Nel di della vittoria, io le incontrai. I won't do the whole thing. The Italian letter from Macbeth, Lady Macbeth's singing role, which Maria Callas sang famously. And in the play Masterclass, in which I played Maria Callas, I had to learn this particular piece of Italian, Lady Macbeth's letter. And I do that every night as a warm-up because it requires such deftness, lips, teeth, tongue, you know, the coordination of those pieces of resource that we have to use frequently, and breath control. So there are pieces from old plays that I've done that I like to retain. It's like people still quote poetry that they learned at school. It's a similar thing.
Yeah, I'm sure. I note with interest that in Other Desert Cities you're back with John Gayden, who, like you, is on my shortlist of the Australian greats. Now, you've known John, God help us, since the early days at the Old Tote and Nimrod.
Yes. Yes, before that, I think I can't even remember. I can't remember, but I know we did with Richard Wirt directing, we did a school's production of Antony and Cleopatra, in which he played Antony and I played Cleopatra. And I remember we had a blazing row. It was all because I was complaining about something, the way it was being done. I was unhappy with it and it made me tense and I had a bit of a hissy fit. And I got a wonderful telegram from Richard Werrett that night saying something like, I wish I could quote it. You see, this is where I'm failing utterly because it's not a script. It was a personal message, but it said something like, you know, it's all in the manner, not the words, or something or other. And he was suggesting to me that I find a better way of managing my frustration in the rehearsal room. It was very sweet and very memorable. But it was one of those productions we took out to schools where they could ask us to do any scene from the play that they were interested in seeing, which is a great, great process for them.
Okay, it raises the other issue, remembering the lines, remembering the positions, the moves. This is one thing. But creating a character is a very mysterious business. And once again, let's go back to Blakemore, who describes the Olivia, who isn't called Olivia, preparing for a part. And as you know, Lawrence often started by giving himself a nose. He'd sit down, you know, with a whole lot of nose putty and a palette knife, and he'd shape himself a conch and then work the character back from that, which seems a very odd way to go about it. How do you create a character? How do you start this mysterious process?
I think it very much depends on the character and the play. For example, as an ancient Jewish rabbi, all I can think, or Jewish rabbi, an ancient rabbi with a strong Eastern European accent who has lived many years in the Bronx, I start with the voice. So the voice is a combination of Eastern European and Bronx. And the fact that he's from a completely different era, and a great deal of facial hair, Philip. There's no getting away from it. And somehow I have to new eyebrows and long hair. It would be quite a transformation. So some roles, if you're lucky enough to be given an accent, as in an American play, I sort of see the accent as a kind of mask.
Isn't it interesting, though, that for Australian actors, for generations, they very rarely got the chance to play Australians. And so they became very good at doing accents. They could do Arthur Miller, they could do Noel Coward, they could do, you know, some of the new playwrights from the North Country, or, you know, they could do Tennessee Williams, but they could live or die very often without ever cracking it to play an Australian. So the accent has been a two-edged sword for us.
Well, I think part of the reason for that is that our ways of speaking are various now, but are fundamentally quite lazy. I mean, we have very lazy speech patterns. We don't use our lips, teeth and tongue the way other nationalities do. And this means that we're able to adopt rather more easily than others are, accents from foreign tongues. I mean, the American accent, I've had lessons with American dialect coaches, and they work you very hard. They work your jaw very hard. It's the placement of the jaw that's so critical. And this is so also for English accents. It's very hard work when you first start to shape those words because, as I say, we are so lackadaisical. Our energy levels are kind of very different, very, you know, relaxed. And so it's a real effort initially to learn those accents, particularly from America and English-speaking, you know, French accent, German accent, Dutch, all of those. They're very, very hard to do initially until you get into the swing of it.
You're mentioning a play that's set in New York. Think of all the accents in that one city.
Well, that's right.
They change up and down all over the place.
Absolutely. And there's no such thing as an American accent, of course. But we have very sophisticated dialect coaches now who take us into specific areas. Then you have to take into account that this person grew up in the Midwest, but moved to California and lived 20 years in California, then married a Frenchman. You know, it's complicated. But you find too that some audiences are very particular about their American accents and they're quite critical of them, but they don't understand the specificity that we've actually achieved. And they think it sounds a little bit odd to their ear because they're used to much more kind of middle of the road, acceptable, you know, Americanese, which isn't perhaps as genuine as they think.
LNL on RN, and I'm talking to Robin Nevin. Robin, as you have, in fact, worked all over this wide brown land, I listed the QTC, the STC, the MTC. Are you able to identify Australia's regional accents?
A little bit. There are some... South Australia used to be quite identifiable. There were some vowel sounds, and they drop G's a bit, and they say you, how are you? the Brisbane accent used to be all up there, like talking up like that all the time. Always question marks in the sentence. But now, I mean, that I can remember when my daughter started doing that in the 80s, and I was demented about it, these upward inflections. And it does give you a kind of national characteristic of uncertainty. And I find it so irritating because I kind of prefer the very definite full stop ending.
You know, you're currently playing, as you say, one of those Jewish rabbis as opposed to other sorts of rabbis. I think you should be playing an Antipodean Professor Higgins in a forthcoming production of My Fair Lady.
Oh, but that's huge fun.
My Fair Lady reminds me of A Cheery Soul, and your performance of Miss Docker, God help us, back in 1978, thoroughly startled Patrick and his partner Manoli. They were totally taken aback by your transformation of Miss Docker into a crusading, bizarre, outlandish meddler. Were they so taken aback they were miffed, or did they express pleasure in the outcome?
I remember vividly the moment they came into my dressing room after the opening night, and Patrick was silent and a bit teary, and Patrick and Manoli said, "Moments of genius." And Patrick gave me the most wonderful gifts. He gave me a wonderful George Balderson picture, which I treasure. And he also gave me a very serious diamond brooch, with many, many, many diamonds in it. It was like a spray of, you know, wattle or something.
Yeah.
And it was so kind of over the top, I couldn't wear it. And it was stolen, and it was the most terrible, terrible moment. I rang him up to for the confession, because when you start life as a Catholic, you continue to confess. And I rang him up, and I said to Patrick, "Patrick, your brooch was stolen." And there was a long silence, and then he said, "Was it insured?" And I said, "No, Patrick." And there was another longer silence, and he said, "You're all gypsies and vagabonds." And it was the most cutting comment he could have made.
Gypsies, vagabonds, rabbis, and of course, you now confessed, a Catholic girl. I didn't know that. Tell me about your humble origins.
I went to Genazzano Convent in Melbourne, and until I was 11. So my parents were Catholics and Robert Menzies fans and devotees, and I can remember the moment of distress on my mother's face when she realized I was marrying an employee of the ABC, which inevitably meant to her that I was destined for life as a Labour voter. So her...
She was wrong. There, you've always been notoriously politically conservative, haven't you? Joke.
Irony. Gladdy, as a devoted Gladdy, I should recognise that. So I went to Melbourne here till I was 11. Then we moved to Tasmania, and I went to a small private school run by a wonderful woman called Audrey Morfitt, who, in partnership with her partner, Miss Travers, ran this small independent school for girls, which was very special. I was very lucky. And
but she adored you because she put you in the lead in every single play she put on.
She did, that's right, and wasn't I blessed? And that's exactly why I've continued to this day, because she instilled into me a great sense of responsibility for everything, really, that everything I did was worth doing well. I remember her saying to me one day, "If a thing's worth doing, Robin, it's worth doing well." Now, I've remembered that, and I must have been about 11 when she said it. So she obviously said it with some depth of intent or meaning or something.
Well, despite the political risks that lay ahead, the fact that you'd be lured into the ultra-left and become a wobbly, your parents were sufficiently impressed with your performance of Snow White, for example, that they let you go to Sydney to the just open NIDA. The beginnings of things are so exciting.
Yes, and so uncertain. It was regarded with a great deal of suspicion by the profession in Sydney. We were all considered as spoilt young people being sent off to a kind of finishing school by rich parents. None of that was the case at all. But there was a sort of resentment, I think. It was interesting. And there was a terrific kind of hoo-ha that accompanied the opening of NIDA. It was hugely publicised. And the irritating thing in looking back, and indeed at the time, even though I didn't sort of understand the politics, was that on the day there was huge media coverage and there were guests from visiting British performing arts companies, theatre companies, sort of glowing, glittering English theatre stars were present. And it was such an irony when you think of it, because this was really one of the beginnings of, or one way of beginning to produce an Australian way of making theatre, as opposed to the imports by which we were surrounded at the time.
I tell people the story, and they find it hard to credit, that in the 1960s, and of course NIDA opens in the late 60s, there are only four or five Australian plays professionally produced. These days, of course, there seem to be that many every week. We've come a long way, baby.
We've come a long way, baby, and it's wonderful to be part of that history and to know that history and to value that history. And I hope that organisations that are training young theatre makers are teaching that history. It was interesting. I was listening to John Fane on 774 here in Melbourne the other morning, and he had Leo Schofield on his show, and I was thrilled to hear Leo talking about the festival of music that he's producing at the Theatre Royal in Hobart, which is where I began my career.
And what a theatre to begin at.
Indeed. Wasn't I blessed? But I think it's wonderful that someone like Leo is giving it such, giving it a new life as he is. But somebody rang in to say how they knew the Theatre Royal. They remembered seeing Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh performing in that theatre. And I texted in to say, and who remembers seeing Robin Nevin at that theatre playing Snow White? I mean, it was a joke, but it was, part of it was my sort of irritation at the fact that the theatre is still, that particular theatre is still celebrated for the fact that Olivia and Vivian Leigh performed there, and it's never known that I actually started at that theatre, and it had a huge impact on me, the building itself. And it's an aspect of Australia.
Well, we should point out to the listeners that it is the most exquisite, beautiful little theatre in the Southern Hemisphere.
It's a Georgian jewel. Its proportions, its dimensions, its acoustic, they're all absolutely wonderful. It's very limited in terms of its wing space. You can't have big sets in there, but who cares? It's just exquisite and should be celebrated as such.
It raises the issue of teaching acting. Is it innate? Can it be taught? There are so many competing theories about how actors should be trained. You know, NIDA's approach is, I think, has subtle differences from RADA or from, the method at, in Manhattan. Do you have a view about that dilemma? Can you teach a really talent? Can you create real talent? Or does it have to be there before you start training?
I don't have a developed view about it, but I do believe in innate talent. And if you start with that and then you receive training and you're fortunate enough to be able to practice, then I think you have an advantage over those people who are not born with a gift, but who are born with an ambition and pursue that and dedicate themselves to pursuing a career. I think one's got the edge over the other, and I'd rather watch the first rather than the latter. But I think that it might be different for film, for screen. I think there's a way of editing a performance on screen so that you can really control, you shape it through the editing process, which is something you can't do on
film
stage.
I don't think film counts in the same way as acting, proper acting on stage. There are so many other considerations, as you say, editing, lighting, cinematography, the swirl of magical music, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're up on stage, when you're sort of caught in that spotlight like a kangaroo, It's tough. It really is tough. Now, Malcolm Gladwell would agree with you. He's got a theory that everyone who becomes incredibly successful puts in 10,000 hours of practice. And he makes the point the Beatles had 10,000 hours, you know, in Hamburg, playing all night, every night, forever, long before they became, megastars. He makes the same point about Bill Gates. Not that Gates was a genius, but that he had the absolute good fortune to have access to one of those rare things called a computer and did his 10,000 hours before he emerges, yes, Bill Gates. And, of course, you did your 10,000 hours, not only at places like NIDA, but where I first became aware of you. You actually, you know, worked the... what is effectively the primitive life forms of Hector Crawford programs. you were in Matlock.
I love Malcolm Gladwell's theory, and I've either heard him interviewed or I've heard that theory before, and I absolutely support it and applaud it. It's absolutely the truth. I don't know whether he's saying therefore you don't need that initial spark.
No, what he says is that genius isn't going to deliver success in and of itself. It is better to have reasonable talent, but to put in the 10,000 hours.
That's right. And it's also kind of related somehow to that notion of finding the form to contain the chaos, that art is really a way of chaos organized into a very beautiful form, you know, and that's always the artist's a discipline has to be that you may have all these ideas and emotions and thoughts and fear and da-da-da-da, but until they're translated, shaped into a beautiful form, they're kind of useless, really. They're just nice for you to have.
Your parents had their problems and periods of separation. Do you mind me sort of invading your privacy in this area?
Well, no. My father was an alcoholic. My father was a businessman here in Melbourne. He was the head of Dunlop Rubber Company here. And he developed that terrible drinking problem. And he was a full-blown alcoholic and retired early as a result. So my mother took the three daughters and moved to Hobart. And it was very difficult. It's interesting that you would bring it up because I was thinking about this only the other day. It was very difficult in that period, which would have been 42, mid-50s, to suffer the embarrassment of an alcoholic husband, and particularly one who was in quite a high-profile position. And she returned to Tasmania, where they'd started their married life. And she was ostracised, I think, pretty much by Hobart society, such as it was. And when I went back, I was invited back to my old school there to make a speech at some occasion, some anniversary of the school. I made it about my mother and about that sad circumstance in which she found herself returning to a place where she'd been happy and had good memories and good friends, but was ostracised because of the kind of blight of my father's reputation, which had caught up with Hobart society.
And of course, there are no secrets in Hobart.
No, there are no secrets in Hobart. But you know, what a silly and sad thing. But yes, so we were. My mother was a struggling single mother for some time. So that was a very sad, sad period, very difficult, dark period.
And yet you won't have a bar of the theory that actors choose their path so they can work on their emotional problems, or rather, if they do choose their path to work on their emotional problems, you disapprove.
I don't know. That may be the case for some people. Look, I haven't looked at that. I have been contracted to write a memoir, and maybe when I do, I'll look at that. But I don't need to look at it because I just go to work every day and do what I do. But what I do in a very practical way is to use my emotional, the well of stuff that's stuck down in there somewhere. And I lock into that if I need to relate to some sad and difficult circumstance to help me imaginatively with this role, whatever role I'm doing. So
but you are on the record as saying that you loathe self-indulgent acting with the actor cries instead of the audience. It's the actor's job to make the audience cry.
Exactly, exactly. It's not, we're not there for therapy purposes. We're there to
Ellenelle on R.N. Summer, and my guest is leading thespian Robin Nevin. The thing I didn't know about you was that you spent 4 years, this is a part of the 10,000 hours, as a television presenter in Tasmania, and you won lots of Logies, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, that was hard slog, Philip. I didn't enjoy that. I found it terrifically stressful, but obviously it was also a wonderful experience. I did a lot of ABC radio as well. I mean, they used me in whatever, you know. I did television shifts on camera between programs as a sort of on-air female hostess, which they had in that era. And then I did a lot of radio stuff as well. I did a program called The Batman and Robin, if you can believe it. The Food Man and Robin, which was based on, you know, the Batman reference. And I did concert recitals and I did all sorts of things, late night lineup sort of stuff. In fact, I had what may have been a ubiquitous nightmare, which was that I arrived for the midnight to dawn shift, which I never in life actually did. But I would arrive and take over from the announcer who was going home for the evening. And the technician also went home. So I was there. In those days, didn't have a producer. So I was there in the studio on my own, and I said goodnight to them. They walk out, and I switch on the microphone. And as I do, my eyes hit the record shelves on the other side of the studio, and they are all empty. So I am faced with a microphone and nothing. And that was the nightmare.
You hardly, however, survived your membership of a travelling troupe performing Shakespeare to kids in outback Queensland.
Mm. That was tough. That was really tough. But again, it's kind of wonderful training, really. We did Macbeth and Julius Caesar, I think. And I actually replaced an actress who'd had a nervous breakdown up in Townsville or Rockhampton, because she was terrified that her lover at the time, who was living in Sydney, would be the next victim of the Sydney slasher. The Sydney slasher being a notorious criminal of the period who cut off men's genitals in public lavatories. And she was convinced that this was going to happen to her mate. So she had a genuine breakdown. She was taken away, and I replaced her. But that was hard work, because we were doing Shakespeare, potted Shakespeare to schools, and it was heavy on narrative and short on scenes, and we did them on tabletops and in school halls and gym halls and terrible acoustics, very difficult circumstances. And we set up ourselves, then we packed up everything and drove in a bus across the outback, and it was really tough. But as I say, I suppose it was really well, you know, you sow what you reap.
Exactly so. Now, we've talked about your first marriage to the ABC producer, mm-hmm. the father of Emily. You had a, and this is interesting to me, because going back to this notion of the celebrity actor as opposed to the one that sort of doesn't sort of cop that all that much, you haven't put much of your private life up for examination. You're not exactly, you know, a regular feature in the women's mags. But you had a short marriage to Jim McNeil, a.k.a. the convict playwright. Was that an exciting interlude?
No, it was very, very difficult. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I'm not going to talk at length about this, Philip, because I never have. But he was an extraordinary man. He's what I would define as a poet. And he discovered his poetic self, I guess, in jail. He was in jail for many, many years. And he developed that side of himself. And he wrote a number of plays, all of which were burnt in the Bathurst fire. I think there were riots in Bathurst jail. And all his material was burnt. But he'd shown it to various contacts outside prison who took an interest in him. And it, of course, I was in his play, the prison play that he did in Sydney, and that's how we met. And it was a kind of whirlwind romance, as the saying goes, and as the saying is lived out. But he was an alcoholic, and he was very troubled, and he couldn't handle going back into the world, and he self-destructed, and he was destructive to others, and so we parted.
And now, of course, you've been with Nicholas Hammond for many decades, haven't you?
I think it's 25 years.
So you're hardly on P plates, you two. I think you're... is he still under warranty?
He's doing okay.
Okay, let's get back to thesping. You told Susan Mitchell, this is, God help us, way back in 1984, that once you reach performance level, most of your concentration should be almost outside of yourself, looking in. And you talked about developing an awareness, an objectivity, that work on that rather than staying stuck in the pain of, well, the past. So when you're up there, when you've reached the necessary fever pitch for a performance, you're in the audience as much as on stage.
Well, I think all actors have an objective eye on what they're doing. I certainly do. And that objective eye works for me in life, so that if something happens to me and I have a sort of, you know, specific sort of reaction, my recording, my observing eye records it and stores it away for future reference in a rehearsal room. So I'm always sort of partially objective. Though it's interesting because as an audience member, if I'm engaged, I'm wholly present. But once I've been convinced by the performance on stage. If it's not convincing, I'm wholly objective and highly critical. But I'm a terrific audience, actually, if I think it's good. But yeah, I think that objectivity is essential to any good actor. But I'm also in the moment. I mean, although I've got part of my brain always knowing what I'm doing. Like the other night, as I explained to you, when I was having a panic attack in my mind and then thinking about what a panic attack ongoing might be while I was actually doing the role. So, you know, your brain's capable of, as you know, capable of many simultaneous acts.
Yeah. It's going back to Blakemore, he was describing the fascinating tension of every night, that there were always differences in performance, even in his own. Mm. And you know, some nights the whole cast knew they'd brought it off, and other nights, while the audience probably thought it was at least fair average quality, they knew that for one reason or another it had failed. This is a tension level, of course, which doesn't exist in the canned entertainments of cinema or television.
That's right. You know, it's so interesting. I've just, as you mentioned, Top of the Lake, which is the Jane Campion series, which is a completely fascinating piece of work, which I've been watching. It was interesting doing that because I hadn't worked on screen for a long, long time, and Jane has a very, very relaxed set. And Elizabeth Moss, who was playing my daughter, so I did most of my scenes just with Elizabeth, is a consummate screen actress. She's only done screen ever. And she's done it for a long time, even though she's young. And she appears to do almost nothing. And I was just fascinated watching her, thinking, is she doing something? And after a while, I began to think, oh God, I'm doing too much. I'm, you know. And when you see it on screen, that's right. She's doing nothing. I'm doing too much.
Yeah, but it happens to be a series in which nothing and too much can live side by side.
Well, that's true too. That's true too, and that's true drama. I mean, it's like a comedy series I've just finished, which I love doing, and I've never done anything like it before, called Upper Middle Bogan. And it's going out on the ABC, I don't know when. And it's exactly the intention of these writers to put, it's a comic tragedy. It's putting in the comic form. It's building in, poignancy and sadness because it's real life. So it covers all of those aspects, and to achieve those is quite a sophisticated thing to do.
I remember trying to explain to some school children about the Spanish play. and how in the middle of his tragedies, Shakespeare always puts comedy in, not only to leaven it, but in a sense to intensify it. So you get the you get the porter scene, which is full of the first knock-knock jokes in, I think, in recorded history.
Yes, that's right.
And it's up to, you know, the comedy there is up to Monty Python standard, but it doesn't in any way diminish the wallop of the tragedy. And that's the great thing, I think, about great art, that it isn't narrow-minded in terms of its focus.
Well, it's kind of, yes, it's kind of, it takes life and then takes it, it emulates life but takes it further, it's bolder than life because, you know, everybody's got stories about deeply sad circumstances in which, in the middle of which somebody giggles and somebody says something inappropriate, but it's funny. It's just life. It's those extremes teetering on the edge of all the time, you know. It's, and if that is captured in art, it does make it extraordinarily pleasurable and real.
Well, let's talk about teetering on the edge, because one of the most challenging things you ever faced, where getting into the character, I know, proved to be particularly difficult, was when you were working on the 90-minute one-woman production of Joan Didion in the Year of Magical Thinking. I would have thought that being alone on stage, absolutely trapped, would be a greater challenge than even doing Queen Lear.
It's not. But anyy, yes.
It's not.
It's not.
Lear's
that is,
worse.
Lear's greater because, as well, not because, but John Bell describes Lear as the ball terror. And being ball-free zone, I can't vouch for that, but certainly it's the biggest thing you can ever do. But the great thing about having done Lear is that you kind of look at anything else and you think, oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. There is nothing, I think, to equal the challenge of Lear. But the Joan Didion piece, well, I suppose what I immediately think of when I think of the Year of Magical Thinking is getting to know Joan Didion. And so I feel so blessed to have had that meeting with her and the ongoing relationship which we now enjoy, which has been such a gift.
Who chose Cate Blanchett to direct?
I did.
Right. And you said you knew that Cate would be aware of all the actor's tricks and tactics you might employ.
Well, I knew that she would understand because I just knew that she would direct it the way she would want to act it. And because I had directed her, I know how she acts, and she and I have a lot of kind of approaches and ways of being in the rehearsal room in common. I'm not comparing myself with her from a million years, but our approach to work is similar in certain ways. So I knew she would be sympathetic to the way I worked, and that was very important to me.
John Bell says of you, and this I don't think was specifically addressing Lear, Niven goes for it. She doesn't muck around or fiddle around the edges, and I've seen that grow over the years. She's a real instinct for where she's heading in a performance. Some actors take weeks to get to that. They hold back and not try things and just test out all their options. She bounces right into it. When you are directing as opposed to acting, do you encourage actors to be that daring or do you like to work them up?
No, I think each actor's different and they bring different processes. And that's the hardest thing about being a director is being able to manage each, to manage the room so that you're addressing each actor as an individual and you don't put the same expectations, even though you have to put a general kind of expectation on the progress of the piece itself. So that is a collective expectation in a way. But within that, you need to understand that some people are, you know, take longer in certain ways. Other people try out 50 different things and dismiss them all quickly. I mean, there are just many different ways of being in a rehearsal room, and having a sensitivity towards those individual ways is terribly important. And I don't know whether I succeeded at that, but certainly I took that awareness into the room.
You and I and your friend David Williamson have always been strong on the need for Australians to tell their own stories rather than have them written for American audiences. How do you think we're travelling on this point at the moment?
I think we're travelling well. I do. I think we're travelling well. I don't think anymore that that's no longer an issue. There are so many. I mean, it's so interesting in the last kind of decade. There have been these people who've come out of various training institutions, notably Flinders in South Australia, and the VCA too, and of course NIDA, I suppose, you know, nationally. But the Flinders one is particularly interesting, where these people come out and they're these young practitioners and they want to be theatre directors. They don't want to be in film. They want to be theatre directors. And I find that absolutely fascinating because before that there was a kind of ambition, generally speaking, to work on film, to work in the film and television industry. And theatre was a bit kind of, you know, unfashionable. But these terribly interesting, extremely well-educated, very bright, smart young people who are the next generation, up and coming in their mid-30s, I suppose, 30s up, who come in with this, who are theatre animals. And that's going across directors, writers and designers. And it's very encouraging. So I think the theatre's in good hands.
You know, it's as I sit and talk to you and I think about you playing Cleopatra, Lady Macbeth, Martha in Virginia Woolf, Blanche in Streetcar, Maria Callas, all these parts, hardly a mountain left to climb, I suddenly realise that for me, despite a lifetime spent in and around the movies, is that my most vivid memories are of moments in theatre. For example, I remember a production, which I guess, with the wisdom of hindsight, wasn't all that great, of Death of a Salesman at the Union Theatre Company. I remember a terrific production by Wal Cherry of the Threepenny Opera. I remember Patricia Connolly suddenly alone in the spotlight in the middle of a huge Brendan Behan spectacular, again and again, for some reason. And I think it's because of the improbability of theatre in a way, that it's such an odd experience, it's such a strange place to be in a theatre, that theatrical memories live on and influence me more than cinema.
But isn't that because it's live, because you're in the room? You're just...
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. You're the human being looking at another human being doing something extraordinary.
And something slightly odd. Blakemore says he finds it very hard to take theatre seriously, even having spent a lifetime in it. You know, he finds it sometimes quite embarrassingly.
Well, I completely understand what he's talking about, because only the other night as I was waiting to go on stage, I thought, you know, it is a funny thing to be doing, getting dressed up in somebody else's clothes, pretending to be somebody I'm not, and people out there sitting paying money to watch me do it. It is a weird thing to be doing.
And people have been doing it for millennia.
Forever.
It has survived all the competition, all the new technologies, all the digital tricks. It still matters. It's like seeing the real object in a museum, isn't it? It's like, you know, looking at the thing rather than the most glossy and beautiful picture of the thing.
And it starts with us being read stories or sung to as babies in the cradle and around the fires of, you know, millennia ago.
Well, you're now a grandmother. I hope you're good at telling stories.
No,
I hope
but
you act them out.
No, I didn't. I wasn't. Look, I've been a terrible parent and grandparent because of my commitment to my art form. I'm just never anywhere. I'm never where I need to be at the time. But speaking of that, it's I remember when my daughter Emily was two or something, we were sharing a house with the Bells. So it was John Bell and Anna Volska and myself, who were the parents of Hilary Bell and Lucy Bell and Emily. And we used to take in turns to read them stories at night. And I've often thought, gosh, weren't those kids lucky? You know, night after night they had these actors going and reading them stories. It must have been a wonderful kind of early period for them, I think.
It becomes a part of the 10,000 hours, I suspect.
That's right,
That sort of cultural enrichment.
Yeah.
We've talked about the mountains you've climbed. What about the cliffs you've fallen off? Do you have, apart from the other night when you thought you were losing it, and thank God that wasn't the case, can you remember, I can remember any number of catastrophes and quite enjoy telling the stories, can you remember one or two total disasters before I let you go?
Oh, I have one. I did a production of a play called Miss Julia, an August Strindberg play, and I think he's probably somebody I would not feel too bad about calling a misogynist. And in Miss Julie, I was working with an actor who is now deceased, and I hate to speak ill of the dead, but he was a wretch. He was a bad actor, and he was encouraged by a very bad director. And the man was gay, and he was playing Jean, who was a full-blooded heterosexual male who was trying to seduce Miss Julie. Well, there was no way, was there? He didn't know what to do with me. So I ended up going to a counsellor, and I went to a counsellor every day to get through that season.
What I
learned out of that was to wait until the... In fact, it was a trick that Ruth Cracknell told me about, which is another story. I was in a comedy, and I came off one night, and Ruth was in the dressing room. I said, Ruth, why don't I get a laugh on that line anymore? And she said, listen. She said, now you watch what that other actor's doing. Watch him and watch him and watch him and wait until he's absolutely run out of anything more to do. Leave a beat, then say your line. I said, well, I couldn't do that, Ruth. She said, do it. So I went on stage for the next few shows and I watched him and watched him and I thought, oh, God, yes, he is doing a lot of fussing. And, oh, yeah, no, but I can't possibly. I couldn't. Anyway, eventually, one day, I screw my courage to the sticking place. I did what she said. I got the laugh, and I went back into the dressing room, and she pointed her finger at me, and she said, that's comedy. And that's a trick that I learned.
And you'd nailed the bastard.
I'd nailed the bastard. And in Miss Julie, that's also what I learnt to do. I just waited until he'd finished frippering around like a girl, and it was like a tennis match. I waited till the audience's attention came back to me, and then I did what I had to. It was just agony. That was the worst experience I've ever had.
It's interesting that, of course, many gay actors can play straight brilliantly.
But of course.
John Hargraves, for example, you know,
but of course,
was fantastic in Don's Party.
It's nothing to do with your sexual proclivity. It's to do with your acting. And,
yeah.
And this man acted like a female, and it was just not helpful to me as a female in a seduction situation.
Now, I don't want to talk you out of another 20 years of business activity, but are you thinking of slowing down a bit?
Nah. No. I'm just somebody's writing a television series for me, and I hope to God it's going to go to air, and that will be... I've wanted to do a television series for 20 years, and I hope this is going to be it.
But a lot of parts have been written for you. David Williamson used to write for you, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. Bless him, he did. And that was wonderful. Now I want to do it on screen.
Give us a hint before I'll let you go back to your busy day.
Well, it's a hint. Well, it's about a retired judge, and that's all.
That's a pretty good hint.
Yeah.
I find it hard to put all that together. Look, you're terrific, Robin, and I thank you very much for coming in. The Grand Dame of Australian Theatre, Robin Nevin. Stick around now for the news on RN Summer. See you next week. Bye for now.